The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network. www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover.
Hi, welcome to Cover to Cover. I'm Mark DeWitt. Today we have the author of his brand new book, and it's titled It's Got a Swing, the John Von Olin Story. This is by Jim Nunn. Jim, welcome.
Hi, Mark. Thank you very much for having me on.
All right, now here we have this guy. He's got glasses on. It's kind of a black and white type cover. It looks like he could be a drummer, perhaps.
He is a drummer. And if you look on the backside, as you probably have, he's a much younger version of the same guy without the glasses. But yes, John is a very, within certain circles, was and is a very well-known and very highly thought of drummer.
It's Got a Swing, John Von Olin. Why the book?
Well, thanks again for asking. And John, if you have any interest in drums or big band and such, John has played around Cincinnati for a number of years. He was Rosemary Clooney's drummer for one third of the country, so he was quite close to the Clooney family. But he played with Stan Kenton, and he started, along with a guy named Don Johnson, he started the Bluest Big Band over 35 years ago. So that's just a little bit of the backstory. I lived across the street from John and his partner, Mary Ellen Tanner, for a number of years in Covington over on 3rd Street. And I didn't know him well, but I would say hello and say, are you guys playing tonight? And that kind of stuff. And again, like I said, if you're a drum fan and such, you knew of John because he's quite a good drummer. But so we chatted up a little bit now and then. And then I was working for a small trade publisher because my background is publishing, not really in trade. It was more in the sciences, but one of my last jobs, a small trade publisher. And I asked if John had any interest in doing a book. And John, who's a pretty laid-back guy, said, yeah, just some simple thing, tell him my story. The trade publisher who I worked with was interested, but they couldn't justify the numbers and such, and because it's business. So I was talking to John again, and I said, heck, if you want, I'll write it. I'm not a professional writer, but I'll write it. And John, again, being so laid back, was like, yeah, sure. So that was about 2 years ago, Mark, and we published it a few weeks ago, and here we go.
You know, I could see John on his drum, and he'd say, yeah, sure, go ahead. And I hear a thadon, but he probably wasn't buying a drum set when he asked.
No, but I would see John's drum set in the back seat of a car, usually parked on the street, because like a lot of talented people, I think they do it more for the love of their craft than they do for the Mercedes they're going to be driving, because John sure doesn't drive a Mercedes.
You know, John ended up in Cincinnati, but not from Cincinnati, I don't believe, and he started out pretty much traveling the country.
You're right. He grew up in Indianapolis, and so if John's, what, in his middle 70s now, so you can figure out about when. His father didn't have a lot of money, but it sounds like his father was a very good guy and encouraged John to do different things. And so John had a training in music because his father encouraged that, but then he was bitten by the drum bug one night, and I can elaborate on that story if you like, but when he was a teenager, and from then on, he was a drummer. And so he started practicing the drums, and then he went to North Texas State, which I guess is like one of the more well-known jazz programs in the country. This was a long time ago, back in about 1960 or the late 50s. And after just a little while, he started playing with bands around there. And John will always tell you that he thinks the best education is the classroom's fine, but playing with people. So that was the beginning of it, and he hit the road with a band that found him back there and around North Texas, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Back in the 50s, early 60s, and he played well into the 1960s with probably a big name band, jazz band, swing band. Here come the English invasion. What did that do to his style of music?
That's a great question. And you're right. I guess, I remember, and I can't think of the name offhand, but John had played with a few big names, Dan Kenton, Woody Herman, and then he, by his own decision, came off the road and was trying to settle again in Indianapolis because he was tired of living on the road. And he finally hooked up with some guys that I guess did a little bit more of what, for lack of a better word, would be kind of jazz fusion. But he really enjoyed it. John's a true big band jazz kind of guy. And he did that for a while. And then because of some health problems, he had trouble with his hearing. I guess he took a break from it. But hearing him talk about it, like a lot of musicians, because music was changing so much, you got to go where how you can pay the rent. He played weddings, funerals, bar mitzvahs, whatever, and there was more and more, as you alluded to, it was rock and roll, and the big band was really not as popular, and he had to do whatever it took to pay the rent, and then finally, I guess he said, I just can't do it anymore. I got to play the kind of music that I want to play, and so he stayed true to his calling.
Jim, in your book, it's got a swing. You talk about John playing for those big-name bands at the time.
Right.
And if he stayed with them for a few years, he pretty much wrote his own ticket, I guess.
You're good at this, Mark. You're right. I appreciate that you read the book, and I take that as a compliment, that he played with, first it was Woody Herman. His goal, his dream was to play one day with Stan Kenton, but he hooked up with Woody Herman, which I certainly remember the name, Woody Herman and the Thundering Herd. And he played with them, and he, after a little over a year, he left because, in his description, he was frustrated that the music just wasn't sounding the way he wanted to. Woody was not upset about it at all, but John, I guess the way music is that the bass and the drums really the bass player have to jive. And he said that the guy who played the bass was a good guy and stuff, but he said we just couldn't make it work, and he grew more frustrated with it, and so he quit. But back to what you said about writing your own ticket, he told me, he said, if you played with Woody Herman for 2 years, you could go do anything. And I think he still had a lot of doors open to him, and he had a lot of options, but he said after a year, he just didn't want to do it anymore with the Woody Herman band because it just wasn't satisfying to him. And John's, I guess, like a lot of artists, he just had this inner calling that he wanted to follow his art and his trade. He couldn't fake it.
Pretty cool. You mentioned that the bass guitar and the drum complement each other. Anymore, I think, through concerts, music, I don't know, even live music, I guess, the bass drum keys the drum, I believe, through computers. I don't know if you know that much about it. John might, he'd probably know more. I don't even know if I know what I'm talking about, but like you say, they do complement each other.
Yeah, they really, I guess, they do. And they follow each other. And according to John, to a degree, you know, he works with the bass player and the bass player leads the way. I don't know if that's true, but sometimes listening to music, especially live, you can tell the way they really they do keep that beat, and the drummers really set the tone for the band. You know, the pace and everything I've read, this is not through John, but I've read because I follow the drums a little bit, that Ray Charles was extremely challenging to play with because it was so slow. You know, I mean, he was obviously wonderfully talented, but, you know, for a lot of us, a slow beat would seem like, well, how hard could that be? But it's like, you got to keep it just the way it is, but it's got to be slow. And we have an inclination, I know, as drummers to like want to go fast. But no, you're the timekeeper, and you got to do it the way the song calls for.
It's all magic to me, I guess.
Oh, boy, some people have the gift, and I'm envious of them because I play at the drums a little bit, but I don't think I really have the gift.
Do you? Now, you know, how tough is that? Because when John first started, he didn't really know all the terms, I think. Isn't there like a roll and other things that drummers do?
You're right. They're called the rudiments of drumming, and I've, in researching this, I know about the rudiments, but whether it's a core number of 13 exercises or 26, it seems to vary a little bit. But John had become quite good at the drums. He'd played with the traveling band in Texas and such, and then he went into the military. He was drafted in the early 60s, so Vietnam was starting to take hold, the challenges there, but I don't think it was the politically controversial or thing it became in the 60s, but still, John hadn't planned. He didn't have any feelings one way or another about Vietnam, but he hadn't planned on going into the Army. But so a friend of his said, whatever you do, apply to be in the military band. And so he did that, and in his words, he failed miserably because you have to do these exercises demonstrating what are called the rudiments, which, you know, are different kinds of, like, different stick exercises, rolls, paradiddles, flams, these things that are certain exercises that are fundamental, certainly, to marching bands and to drumming in general. John feels he almost owes his life to the gentleman who he auditioned with, who was a professional drummer, because he told the guy, he told him about who he'd play with, and the gentleman, the musician, was quite impressed, and he said, please just give me the time, I can learn these rudiments. And so the guy gave him a break and gave him the time to do it, and John, you know, learned them well enough under the grace period of time to where he became a member of the military marching band.
Jim, yeah. You were saying that you drum a little bit yourself, a neighbor with John Von Olin. And did you pick up anything maybe from him to improve your drumming skills?
Oh, boy, I'm a lost cause with that. I think I know more about drumming than I'm able to demonstrate. And this program is not about me. It's about John, you know. But so did I. Just watching him, I've learned a few things. I really do enjoy watching drummers. And as John and I became better friends, or I became more comfortable with him, I would ask him questions, and we'd just kind of talk about different styles of drummings and different things. Because at first I was a little bit more, in awe is the wrong word, but I would never want to act like I could talk shop with John, whose whole life has been professional drumming. And for me, I just kind of goof around at it. But I think I did learn a few things, yes.
John, you know, in music, a lot of people have nicknames like Sticks or, you know, other nicknames. Did John ever have a nickname?
He did. It was the Baron. And I guess some people still know him or know of the nickname the Baron. And according to John, Stan Kenton liked to give some of his musicians nicknames to kind of help promote them and make them seem a little bit bigger than big, and he called John the Baron. He gave him that official nickname, and there were even, I think, one or two records or CDs that John cut later in life where they used the word the Baron in part of the title. So yeah, he was the Baron.
You know, I guess if somebody had the nickname A Flat, that might not be a good thing.
Right. You're right. Like, can't keep the beat, none. You know, you're right. But you can go on YouTube, Mark, and you can find clips of John playing either locally with the Bluest Big Band or with Stan Kenton, and sometimes it's under the Baron, and you can see him doing his thing and listen to it.
Well, Jim, you know, you talked about being in the business, the publishing business, the book business. What's it like on the other side? I mean, you used to work with authors and the such. What's it like now being an author?
Well, this has been a real treat, and just to have this experience, and I don't know whether I will attempt another book. I mean, what makes this special is the subject. It's not the author. To have done this in my life is, and to have been able to have the relationship with John to where he let me into his life and, you know, told me more and more. We talked, we spent many, many, many hours over coffee and such. So I don't know if I'm addressing your question. It's just a real treat to have done this and to have done this in my life. And who knows whether I published another book. I did this. It's called self-publishing. I mean, I paid to have it done and such, as I think you and I may have discussed before. But, you know, people tell me that the book flows pretty well and such, and so I'm comfortable with it. So, but you're right. It's a different point of view. I'm more of a sales and marketing guy than I am the creative author, but it's been a real treat to do this.
What was it like being that author? Were you locked up in a room for days and maybe a little food and water to type? Maybe you get the breezes where you just cannot think of words or the story, and you just had to carry on, and it took years and years, or was it fairly easy?
Oh, I went to a desert island, and I, no, that's a great question, because the book is not fiction. It's not using my imagination as much. I tried to put a little bit of creative, you know, wordplay in there here and there, but my goal with this, Mark, was to have every paragraph or every part of the book have, what, for lack of a better word, content or information. So it was like not dependent upon my pretending to be John Updike or William Faulkner, which I'm certainly not. It was that this book is going to, it's not going to be fluff. It's going to talk about things that John did and such. So my goal was to string those pieces together. So you're right. I think, again, probably like a lot of kinds of creativity, I was best served, and when I've tried to write it other times, when I would just have no distractions and you just try and get focused on what you're doing. And so, you know, spend hours on it. I mean, it's not something I could do just here and there, a little dab, because it takes a while to just get focused on what I'm doing and block out other things and then slowly start to write at it. So that was my experience. But again, my goal was, have this, have content, you know, have it be interesting stuff, even if, you know, and then I'll do my best to sound half intelligent and grammatically correct.
Swing, popular 30s, maybe 40s for sure, 50s, moving up into the 60s. John Von Olen, the drummer of a big name group. You remember the names of the people the orchestras were named after. Not so much maybe the drummer. Do people even remember John Von Olen?
That's a good question there. And I found, I don't know that the word is appropriate, but there's kind of a cult following. Or there are people that do, generally a little bit older, but he still plays with the Bluest Big Band. They've been together for over 35 years. So a lot of people that have been around the music scene in Cincinnati know who he is, and those seem to be some of the folks that are very interested in this book. He plays on weekends at Dee Felice's in Covington, and Dee Felice passed away sadly a number of years ago, but he's a drummer, and the family is quite close to John. But you're right, except for certain circles, probably not as many people. A lot of us have heard of Buddy Rich or Ringo Starr, but a lot of times the drummer doesn't get quite the attention that Frank Sinatra name would or something. But within certain circles, he's pretty well known. And again, with the big band, and for anybody who hasn't heard it, I liken it to like the Johnny Carson band when I was growing up, or you were growing up, you know, with the horn section and stuff. They just really, they fill the room with sound. And you know, John's kind of the leader of it, man. He kicks it in with those drums and off they go.
If I remember right, in your book, it's got a swing. You talk about John befriending a drummer. I don't know if it was the Tonight Show or one of those live shows where he would sit by the drummer and pretty much watch what was going on. I think he was learning at the time.
Oh, you're right. And gosh, I could flip through the book, but I won't do that now. I can't remember the guy's name offhand, but apparently it was, John explained to me, a very well-known drummer. And John was just out of the service, and he was in New York City, and he was checking out the music scene. And he said one of the first places he went into, this drummer who was playing with the Brushes was just fantastic. And he said, he told himself, I can't get a job around here. There are just too many good musicians. But they got to be friends, and this guy was the regular drummer for the Mike Douglas Show.
Douglas, yes.
And John would go with him, and I guess he would just about, he said, lie underneath a cymbal. So he was just off camera, but watch this guy's technique. And so you're right. Yeah, you know, John just, I mean, hearing him talk about it, Mark, he'd spend a whole afternoon just working on the sound of a cymbal. You know, he's just so focused on it and just, you know, how to improve and just playing with sound. And to him, I think it's a lot more than just bang, bang, bang on a drum, you know?
John even played with the actress, singer, nephew of George Clooney.
Oh.
Rosemary.
Rosemary, yeah. Obviously very well known around Cincinnati. And he was, apparently she had three drummers in the United States, one for each coast and then the whole middle of the country. And he was the guy. So he would travel and, yeah, he was quite close to the Clooney family, and I've got a little bit of a story that's not in the book if you want. So John would call me while we were working on this book, and he would, you know, leave a message, and I don't always check my messages right away, like I guess some people, and they play every Wednesday night at the Bluest Big Band does. And so he calls and leaves a message on a Wednesday evening, and I don't check it till the next day, like a bum. Well, he says, Jim, I'm not feeling that well, but I got to go play tonight because I talked to Nick, and he and George Clooney are in town. And so along with George's new wife, they're all going to come and listen to the band. And so you can have a chance to meet them and sit with them for a while if you want to. I didn't check the message till the next day. Of course, I was not too popular in the house, my household, and so one friend said, oh my gosh, it was all over Facebook, George Clooney, and I missed it. But so you're right. I mean, the whole Clooney family is a big fan of John.
Wow, how about that? Who would have thought that, I guess? Have they bought the book or anything to check it out, or is there a story there?
Well, I've talked to Nick, who lives in Augusta, and I've sent him a copy because John wants to give copies of the book to his friends, and so I made sure to send one to Mr. Clooney, and I've met him a few times, but I don't know him well, but I have some friends that know him quite well. But so we'll see, you know, what happens from there, but it was important to John to get a copy to Nick Clooney because he thinks very highly of the family.
So what's happening? What's going on with people from that era, the swing bands, the orchestras? I mean, he's 70-some years old right now. Is there really a following for that type of music anymore?
I think we know of CCM here in Cincinnati, the Conservatory of Music, which is very well thought of. I think for people that are into music, and who's to say what good or quality of music is? As you know, some people like classics, some people like rock and roll. It's just like a book or a movie. The good means different things to different people. But amongst certain circles, there certainly is. I went to hear the Bluest Big Band last night, and I would say that crowd is generally on the older side. You know, some of the guys in the band, they always have new guys from CCM who can sit in with them, and they're younger people that are learning to play the instruments that are into it too. But you're right, I think the masses, I mean, even you and I probably listen to my favorite music and musicians are bands like the Beatles, which I don't know if many people have heard of them as much anymore. But anyway, so there's still a following, but I don't know if it's quite as strong as it used to be.
I think Paul McCartney's still got quite the following.
I imagine you're right.
I think he's one of the only alive ones, besides Ringo, of course.
Yeah.
So it's got a swing. What's your favorite story that maybe you heard from John?
Oh, boy. Well,
I know you heard a lot of them.
No, but this is a good one. And this is it depends on if folks are aware of these two names, Kenny Poole and Cal Collins, two area guitarists who were very good. I mean, Cal played with Benny Goodman, and Kenny Poole was just a magnificent guitarist. And sadly, they're both gone now. But so John gets a gig where he's playing close to Cincinnati, and he would drive in from Indianapolis, and this is when he's just stringing some jobs together, and he's playing with Cal Collins in a trio, and he gets a phone call, and Cal Collins, again, for people that are in the know, these guys were excellent jazz guitarists. So he gets a call from the bass player and says, well, Cal's got a gig, he's not going to be around for a little while, but we got another guitarist. And John said, I'm not making the drive, I don't want to, you know, without Cal. And the guy says, really, this guy's not a bad guitarist. I think you should come. Give it a try. So John drives in, and he didn't know who this person was, but they start to play, and it's Kenny Poole. And John will even say, two of the best guitarists in the country. They both lived right around here. And for people that have listened to music, they were really both magicians. Very different styles, but just wonderful guitarists. So it was something, he said, you know, who would have thought it? Kenny Poole. So that was, you know, a coincidental, a fun story. So he obviously didn't mind playing with Kenny at all. And like I said, Kenny and Cal both passed away just in the last few years, but they were definitely parts of the Cincinnati music scene.
It's got a swing, of course, John Von Olin's story. Still playing at the Blue Wisp?
Well, the Blue Wisp Jazz Club, after moving a few times, closed, but they're playing in a place called Urban Artifacts on Wednesday night. It's not my ideal setting for a big band, but it's very nice that they've served, you know, beer there, and it's nice that the club has them on Wednesday night, so you can go check it out. And some of the guys are getting up there in years, and some of them are youngsters, but they just kick it in, and it's a lot of fun. And then John plays at DeFelice's Thursday, Friday, and Saturdays. It's a little bit more subdued environment. He plays in a trio, and it's a little bit more kind of background music for people that are having dinner. But I know those are two regular gigs that he has.
You know, I knew this guy when he was alive. He was a blues player, and I think I saw him when he was in his 90s, and he could barely walk up to the piano. when he got up to the piano, I thought, okay, what's this guy going to do? But he could stomp his feet, and he was playing that boogie-woogie music. Is John pretty much the same way? Or?
Well, that, it's interesting you say that. I was watching him last night. Oh, gosh, I hope John wouldn't take this wrong. John doesn't look like he does a lot of calisthenics, you know, and he's not the good-looking guy he was when he was a lot younger, but you're right. He just sits there, and he still can kick it into gear, and I read someplace once that Ringo Starr said he's going to play for as long as he can because he said, as long as I can sit on a stool and, you know, hit the drums and stuff. So, so yeah, John, when he sits down there, man, he's still he's not afraid to kick it into gear at all. He does a pretty good job of it.
All right, well, the book is It's Got a Swing, the John Von Nolan story by Jim Nunn. Jim, if I want a copy of this book, where do I go?
The easiest place is to go to Amazon. Just go and type in, I imagine you could type in the title, but you can also just type into the search engine John Von Nolan. And there it is, and click away, and the money goes towards trying to cover costs as well as some promoting music in Cincinnati. And as I mentioned, it's been a real labor of love doing this book. So I wanted to spread the good feeling around. So I'm not too proud to say it's not the principal thing. We could use the money. You know, anybody wants to buy a copy of the book, that would be fantastic.
It's Got a Swing, the John Von Nolan story by Jim Nunn. You know, what a great read, whether you know John Von Nolan or not, whether you like the swing music, drumming. When John was growing up, he had to learn how to play those drums. You'll learn that from Jim in his book, It's Got a Swing. John, no stranger from drugs, just like other musicians during that time. You know, I think he even found Middle Eastern religion right before the Beatles. Jim, thanks a lot.
Oh, absolutely, Mark. Thank you so very much.
Been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Jim Nunn, author of his brand new book, It's Got a Swing.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.